This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our guest in this portion of the program today is child psychiatrist and neuroscientist Bruce Perry. We're going to talk with him this afternoon about how trauma affects children and what's needed to heal trauma's wounds. Dr. Bruce Perry is the author of The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist's Notebook, What Traumatized Children Can Teach Us About Loss, Love, and Healing. Dr. Perry says, quoting here, "Ultimately, what determines how children survive trauma physically, emotionally, or psychologically is whether people around them, particularly the adults they should be able to trust and rely upon, stand by them with love, support, and encouragement." Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, Dr. Bruce Perry. You can join us with a telephone call this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Dr. Bruce Perry is the senior fellow of the Child Trauma Academy, a not-for-profit organization based in Houston that promotes innovations in service research and education in child maltreatment and childhood trauma. You'll find that organization on the web at www.childtrauma.org. Our guest, Dr. Perry, is the former chief of psychiatry at Texas Children's Hospital and the former vice chairman for research in the Department of Psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Perry's book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist's Notebook, is published by Basic Books. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Dr. Perry, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it is my pleasure. You know, when you entered the field of child psychiatry in the early 80s, it was thought that children who experienced trauma would bounce right back. When and how did that thinking change?
Well, it's been a slow process of change. Actually, I think many people continue to believe that children are pretty resilient and they get over major life events, and when they are exposed to traumatic events, they actually will bounce back better than adults. But in the last really 15 or 20 years, we've been learning a lot about how traumatic experiences literally impact the biology of the brain. And because the brain is much malleable when you're young, traumatic events actually have more impact on a child than on an adult. And we've been slowly trying to get this information out into the hands of practitioners and educators and policymakers, but it's a slow process.
Yeah. How different are the brains of children and adults?
Well, in many ways, they're similar in that by the time you're 3 years old, the brain is 90% adult size, and all of the major systems in your brain that regulate thinking and moving and feeling have the fundamental framework put in. So in that regard, there's some similarities, but what's very different, particularly in young children, really young children, from birth up to age 4 or 5, is that the changes in the brain are so rapid, and you essentially are making new synapses at a tremendous rate. You're acquiring new knowledge. Your experiences are shaping how these systems in your brain organize, you know, in a way that's much faster than an adult brain. And I, you know, most of your listeners who have been around young children or who've been parents recognize that there's this explosive acquisition of skills when babies and toddlers grow up. And when you think about it from a biological perspective, the rate of change in the brain of a 2-year-old child is 10,000 times the rate of change in an adult. So a 2-day-long experience for a toddler has tremendous impact on shaping the developing brain, whereas a 2-day experience for an adult is going to potentially influence the brain, but it won't change it in the same fundamental ways.
Yeah. One of the things that is very striking about The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, the book, is the information that you provide about how we develop empathy and what happens when in a situation of neglect when children are emotionally deprived. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about Leon.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the many sad situations that we see in this kind of work. And Leon was a young boy who had two parents, who were in some ways overwhelmed by parenting. Let me back up a bit and sort of talk about the development of the neurobiology of empathy. That, you know, in your brain you have systems that regulate moving your fingers and regulate and control vision and control all kinds of functions. But a lot of people don't realize that there's also a part of your brain that's responsible for your ability to form relationships and your ability to feel compassion and your ability to ultimately be empathic. And that just like every other part of your brain, in order for it to develop normally, there has to be a set of experiences that are patterned and repetitive and that take place at the right time in development in order for those systems that regulate relationships to develop normally. And so under normal circumstances, a baby who has an attentive mother or caregiver who provides touch and rocking and singing and all kinds of other environmental cues that get turned into patterned neuronal activity by the senses of the baby. The skin and the eyes and the ears and the nose have the ability to translate these experiences into patterned neuronal activity, which then go up into the part of the brain involved in forming relationships and provides the sufficient stimulus for those systems to develop. In other words, a child who's been treated in a loving way, behaviorally interacted with in a loving way, talked to in a loving way, develops the neurobiology to love. But a child who's been rarely held or rarely comforted or infrequently or inconsistently consoled and has had their needs met in a very fragmentary way, they do not get the sufficient repetition in that system in the brain for it to develop normally. So it's a little bit like the acquisition of language. Everybody knows that if a child grows up and they never hear someone speak Russian to them, they won't speak Russian. They'll speak whatever the language is that they hear. It's a little bit, that's the same way as love. I mean, if you don't get loving interactions when you are young, you will not develop the language of love, the neurobiological systems to be loving. So Leon was a boy whose mother had an older child. She had just moved to a urban community. Her husband worked a lot and was gone. The baby, Leon, was born and was a kind of a difficult child to soothe, and that overwhelmed her. So rather than getting someone else to help her take care of the baby and or staying with the baby on her own, she would just take her older son, who was a toddler, and they would just leave the apartment for hours on end. So Leon lay in the crib, unconsoled, unfed, undiapered, for long periods of time. And ultimately, his brain made the connection between, it essentially failed to make the connection that human beings meet your needs. Human beings are kind, they're predictable, they sustain you. And the part of his brain involved in compassion didn't develop normal. Mm-hmm. And as he grew up, he engaged in increasingly antisocial, heartless acts, which ultimately culminated in him murdering a couple of girls.
Yeah. The need for nurture is part of our nature, isn't it?
Exactly. That's a great way to say it.
Yeah. Let's take a call from a listener who's waiting for us on a cell phone in Monticello. Good afternoon.
Hi, I have basically an impossible question for you to answer. I have a nephew who was born. He's 7 years old now, and when he was born, they discovered huge necrotic lesions in his brain from some sort of infection he had had. And he was perfectly normal and showed no developmental problems until he got into school. And then they started to find the cognitive problems, the ability to remember a path he had taken. On the other hand, another issue is I have Asperger's. I have fairly severe Asperger's, and I don't understand. I have no concept of empathy at all for anybody. And when I was first born, my mother was sick, so I was in an orphanage for 6 months, so I was fed on a schedule, and I was kind of, you know, just sort of left ignored when I cried, and I never cried when I was young. But my father also has Asperger's. And so here's the question. It's a terrible question, and that is this. First of all, nurturing is obviously important, but the real question that I have is the role of nature and genetics in the development of the brain and the brain functions and the mental functions, and how neuroplasticity evolves over the lifetime of a child. I know that they have findings in adults that they can do, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy for things like OCD, and that seems to have some effect. But do we have any idea of how to separate out the nature and the nurture, and are we learning, how are we doing on that? It seems like it's the same as nature versus nurture, but in a much more fundamental way, because we're now talking brain function. And I'll just hang up and listen to your comments on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. Well, there are lots of areas to comment on with that the question. I think one of the central issues, which is very important, is the relationship between the genetic gifts or vulnerabilities that a child has and how experiences either expresses your potential or is unable to overcome your vulnerabilities. And there's no doubt that for almost all of our human neuropsychiatric conditions, there appear to be individuals who have some genetic vulnerability, and then there are individuals where there's no apparent genetic vulnerability, and they have more of an environmental or developmental set of insults. And it's probably the case that the way we currently classify our disorders is actually a combination of syndromes, some of which might be more genetic and some of which may be less genetic. But all neuropsychiatric functioning, you know, everything that goes on in your brain, literally is a combination of both your genes and how those genes are expressed as a function of the nature, the timing, and the pattern of your developmental experiences. So, you know, a lot of people will read about or talk about or think about the nature versus nurture issue, and it's becoming very clear that it's actually nature and nurture, that it's not necessarily one or the other. In fact, you really require both to develop these systems. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a cop-out, but the answer is that something like Asperger's, for example, is very likely to have some genetic component, and there are people who will have Asperger's-like presentations who were able to get to the same neurobiological state of functioning with purely neglectful experiences early in life. So, for example, lots of the children we work with who have come from Eastern European orphanages have autistic or Asperger's-like presentations, and it's pretty clear that because of the frequency of these problems in that population, that it's not merely genetics. So.
Hmm. The other thing I thought you might comment on is that the caller expressed, he was pretty hard on himself, I think. He said, I have no empathy. And I don't know if that's, the case. I mean, he's got a nephew he's concerned about, and you care to comment on that?
Sure. I it's a funny thing. I think that, there's actually a very interesting dialogue about this in the Washington Post yesterday about how labels, diagnostic labels can kind of sometimes be a little bit misleading. So if you are given the diagnosis of Asperger's, you will be told that forming relational connections is difficult for you and you're just a little bit maybe less connected than other people. And in some cases, it may not be that disconnected.
Mm.
I think, for example, obviously the listener showed elements of being concerned about other people. He may not feel the same intensity and concern that another person might. And I think the way people can understand this is that if you hear about a colleague's friend's daughter who was just diagnosed with breast cancer, you have a reaction of, oh, that's too bad, and there's a certain level of emotional pull. But if you find out that your own daughter is diagnosed with breast cancer, you have a tremendously different emotional pull.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have Asperger's have that kind of first kind of reaction. They can have a little bit of an emotional response, but it's sort of attenuated. It's a little bit diminished. So they can show concern and care, but it doesn't have usually that emotional burst with it.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is a child psychiatrist and neuroscientist. His name is Bruce Perry. He is the author of The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and other stories from a child psychiatrist's notebook, What Traumatized Children Can Teach Us About Loss, Love, and Healing. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. What kind of differences are there between individuals and how they experience stress and trauma? Why does it seem that something that's extremely stressful to one person doesn't bother the next guy at all?
Yeah, but, that's a really important question, and it is at the heart of a lot of important clinical and research issues in this area. And the question is sort of, what is trauma? Or even, what is stress? And as you point out, you can't always define it by the experience. Because, in fact, for one person, what may be overwhelming is actually not so bad for another person. And part of this is related to there really are several factors. One is that the stress response systems in your brain can be either very flexible and reactive, or they can be overactive and hyperreactive. So that and I think, again, if you think about children or people you've known, some were just able to deal with life's ups and downs with, staying calm and a cool head, and things didn't bother them too much, whereas other people just get thrown off by the tiniest little thing. And typically that's because they have this different level of stress response reactivity. Now, what can determine that reactivity is actually earlier life experiences. So if you grew up in an environment where there's a lot of chaos and threat, exposure to domestic violence, you had a previous traumatic event, you're much more likely to have this poorly regulated and overreactive stress response, which means that when another traumatic event comes along, you're much more vulnerable. So, for example, when we looked at the outcome of children after 9/11, the Oklahoma City bombings, Katrina,
mm-hmm.
What we see, and when I say we, it's the multiple investigators looking at this, but what was observed was that the children who had pre-existing family chaos, pre-existing exposure to violence, pre-existing neuropsychiatric problems develop trauma-related disorders, like post-traumatic stress disorder, at a rate about twice that of children who didn't have any pre-existing vulnerability. So the ability to manage a current stressor is related to your history of previous exposure to traumatic and stressful events. And interestingly enough, and I think most listeners think that stress, you know, you hear the word stress, you go, oh, that's bad. You know, and you hear all this stuff, stress bad for the body, and stress is bad. But the fact is, in order for you to build in a stress response system that is flexible and strong, you need to have moderate, predictable stress. In other words, you have to activate these systems in a moderate, predictable way. It's a little bit like you would have to build strength in a muscle by having moderate, predictable work. You have to lift weights to make that muscle stronger. And that's what we find, that the children who are resilient, who deal well with stress, are children who have had opportunities for multiple previous but controlled stress. A classic example would be the child who's in the third grade, and the teacher at the beginning of the year says, every child in this classroom on Fridays has to get up and recite two lines from a poem they've memorized. And in the beginning, you know, public speaking is terrible for a lot of people. They're very anxious, they're very overwhelmed, but they do it Friday after Friday after Friday after Friday. And this moderate, predictable activation of the stress response leads to, at the end of the year, an entire class of children who have no fear of public speaking. And that's, it's the same thing with dress rehearsal, and if you're in the performance arts, you know, you practice under sort of full theater conditions, and under in athletics, you know, you have you know, practice games, and the more you do of these moderately stressful events where there's elements of control, the better you'll perform later on.
This is what you call use-dependent development, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
That's really very interesting. So things get laid down on our brain, the patterns.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So is it possible to undo what is laid down on the brain with patterned repetitive activity?
It is. It is. And in fact, a big part of what we and other clinical researchers in this field have been doing is trying to figure out the best ways to provide patterned, repetitive, reparative experiences that can help these systems that are poorly regulated become more well-regulated, basically. And it's been a challenge, actually. You know, the a lot of the things that we're finding that actually help influence the stress response systems in positive ways are kind of unconventional. They aren't the typical medical model that you might think. So young children who have been exposed to domestic violence and have sort of these trauma-related changes in their brain, and they tend to be inattentive and have an increased startle response, and they're anxious, don't sleep, they actually get really a lot better when you put them in music and movement classes. Pattern, repetitive, somatosensory activities that are rhythmic really help the brainstem become more regulated, and it helps their symptoms. But I think most parents and most people listening, you know, they wouldn't think that if you go see some fancy shrink that, you know, you're going to go put on music and dance around.
I don't know. It sounds good to me.
Those are the things that we're finding are really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Kind of a number of comments and something of a question here. First, I'm really finding this interesting, but it's been a long time since I've taken any neuropsych courses, but any time they dealt with the brain or the subject matter was thinking, I found it awful, very imprecise. Point one, so I find it a little bit difficult to follow that there's precise centers in the brain or da-da-da that relates to this and that in the external world and so forth, but maybe that's my ignorance. Two, I wanted to bring up the double bind theory in the formation of schizophrenia that was formulated by Gregory Bateson a couple of decades ago, mm-hmm. and made popular by Ronald David Lang, something of a heretic in the field, I suppose, still. And three, and what effect that could have on the brain in terms of the double bind theory, in terms of it altering the brain, altering the chemical pathways, and so forth and so forth. And three, the comment, I think the doctor somewhat expressed a terrible, sad situation with Leon in somewhat slightly biological terms. Listening to that, I felt that another way of looking at that is this child was deprived of every form of nurture and love that he should receive from his mother, and I could conceive of him being extraordinarily angry and full of rage towards women, and eventually expressing that in some, that may be an oversimplistic way of looking at it, but that it was eventually expressed in, I think you mentioned he murdered several women, tremendous hostility, and I'll just hang up and listen as I rambled on a bit there, but thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Where do you want to start?
Well, I think the last comment is actually, you know, there's some truth to that, that there was part of his makeup was if he really had made associations, connections to women that were not positive. In fact, he felt, you know, his needs weren't met, and his associations with his primary, you know, connection to female figures was built in from his earliest experiences with his mother, which was, from his perspective, very neglectful and withholding and not able to meet his needs. So I think that, you know, it's different language, but I think that it's probably a reasonable concept that he was rageful towards women, mm. part of being neglected. The other comment about, you know, the beginning comment about finding centers in the brain that mediate things, again, actually is quite insightful because, you know, we talk about a part of the brain doing a function. And it really, when you look at the complexity of the human brain, it turns out that actually what is mediating the function is this complex network of neuronal connections that are widely distributed through the brain. So it's a little bit simplifying to say that there's a center in the brain that does X. But it is accurate to say that there is a part of the brain that is necessary to have that functional network work. So again, this is sort of complex systems neurobiology, but the brain is not like other organs in that it is geographically organized in an easy way. It's very complex and interactive. Mm-hmm. So, and I think the other comment that was about the double, what does a double bind do to the brain? And
yeah, I don't even know what the double bind theory is, so maybe you'd start there.
Well, I mean, I'm sure I will do a disservice to the theory, but the bottom line is that when you send people mixed, when you send an individual, particularly a child, mixed signals,
mm-hmm.
if you do this, good, and then sometimes if you do too much of it, bad, and the child basically gets mixed signals about how to do all kinds of things. So they're in a bind, you know, they're sort of like, they kind of, if they do it one way, it's not right, if they do it another way, it's not right, and they get this mixed signal that from their primary caregivers. And I think that would build into the brain kind of an ambivalence of action, which some people felt might be related to what is seen in schizophrenia. But that's as the caller pointed out, that's actually turned out to not be particularly insightful or accurate about what's going on with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt that when people, I mean, this is a very common parenting issue, that if you have a child and they have one parent that sends one set of strong signals about this is good, this is good, this is good, and another one sends signals that this is not so good, this is not so good, it's very confusing for the child.
Hmm.
And the classic example is the way, you know, maybe parents that are separated or divorced discipline in different ways. and it can be really a challenge for the child.
Yeah, or the child works it.
Yep, exactly.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Bruce Perry.
Hi. There's actually a couple issues. One is that in terms of the stress on children, you say, you know, in terms of moderate stress, but it seems to me that in our culture that kids have too much stress, you know, to achieve, to, I don't know, it seems to me, and maybe I'm old-fashioned in that regard, but in terms of a chance to be kids or children, I don't know what your reaction on that is, but or this comes into your research at all or not.
Well, actually, it does quite a bit. You know, I would agree with you that there is, our children are, in general, being put into situations that are, there are more demands, more expectations, more scheduled time, less free time, less spontaneous play, less opportunity for informal relational interactions. And I think that that's to the detriment of our children.
And
part of, go ahead.
Go ahead. Another issue that concerns me, and I don't understand quite why, but on the other side is that when they do these studies, and I know Celeste had an author, and I don't recall what the title of the book was, but in terms of happiness, that, you know, in terms of raising the children, that that they're not too happy on the average, you know, and that's also stress on the parents, you know, back and forth. But I don't understand this either. What's wrong? You know, what's, I don't know if you're familiar with these studies at all in terms of, you know, average, that, you know, it's not a high point, you know, and a lot of parents are waiting for the kids to get out or something or other. But I don't understand that issue either. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if I can speak directly or exactly to that point, but one of the things that we do know is that children in our modern world actually have more material things and fewer relational interactions than even the last generation. And there's part of our brain, part of the human makeup, has a longing to be part of a group, to be connected, to have social interactions. But and, you know, the brain, you know, we live in extended family models for such a long period of time with the elderly around and babies and lots of different kinds of interactions over the course of a given day. All of that has been tremendously altered so that the typical American child now has about 1/15th the number of social interactions in a day that a child had about two decades ago. And I believe that that leads to a sense of disconnectedness and unhappiness. And unfortunately, our culture tries to fill that void by convincing people they need to get a different color cell phone, or they need to get the right iPod, or they, you know, they get some material thing that somehow is going to fill this relational void. And I think that that's part of why our children are fundamentally perceived. They will say that there's this tremendous unhappiness and unsettled feeling that is seen when these surveys are done.
Yeah, I think the author that the listener was recalling is he wrote a book. I think the title is something like The Importance of Play, and one of the themes of the book is, and what his message is kids need to put the day planner aside and unstructured play with other children, or structured play that the children structure, is really critical.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree completely. And it's, you know, interesting from a neurobiological perspective, from a perspective of sort of fostering creativity and exploration and all the kinds of things that we say we want our children to have, unstructured play actually is better than highly structured cognitive academic activities. And we just seem to have lost that point.
Oh. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Really, really interesting subject. It's sort of in its infancy, I think. But do you feel that, I mean, this may be out of your purview, but do you feel that the more and more they learn about the structure of the brain and how the brain works and how it's influenced by early environmental instances like you keep speaking of, that the society will start to look at responsibility for, let's say, activities that you do later on, like, you know, people, like earlier someone mentioned about people that become, ignored by their parents or mother or whatever and have hateful tendencies towards women or violent tendencies and all that sort of, you know, out in the outer edges of psychology now. But do you know if there's going to be any, do you feel there's going to be sort of like, I'm not looking for the word excuse, but sort of explanation and maybe some interceding on the part of the medical profession or the psychiatric profession? Do you know anything about that, or do you think?
Yeah, I actually do know a lot about that, and it is an interesting area. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're pointing out something that's really, really important in our culture and our law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For example, the Supreme Court has said that if one part of the brain is not very well developed and doesn't work very well, you cannot sentence somebody to death.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, if the cortical part of your brain involved in cognition is not normal, you cannot be put to death. So we've already sort of brought the brain into our law.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a very far leap to say, well, what about another part of the brain? Well, why is that cognitive part of the brain? What if the part of the brain involved in forming, you know, empathy? What isn't normal? Why should they be as responsible as somebody whose part of the brain is as normal? And already there have been arguments in courts to try and use, you know, this early exposure to neglect as an exculpating factor in the death sentence. And it's been applied, and actually it is considered what's called an attenuating factor.
Mm-hmm.
If there are very well-documented history of abuse and neglect, then that should be taken into consideration in whether or not you actually apply the death penalty or just sentence somebody to life.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the reason I think this is because of the fact that I remember reading very recently about a man who had been years ago arrested and was being tried for child molestation. Then he collapsed in court or something to that effect, and he had a brain tumor. They removed it. He all of a sudden had no interest in children again, as sexually, and then they let him go. Maybe this is years ago. They let him go, and then all of a sudden his brain tumor grew back, and he started being, you know, a pedophile again. So I'm just wondering if you take these singular cases, but then you begin to look with, you know, modern, like you're talking about, the amazing amount of information that's being gathered on the brain, the physical brain itself, and then also applying it to behavior patterns and stuff. I'm sure they've been doing that for years, but I find your subject really interesting. But I'm also thinking that it's going to really kind of screw up the law, because the law is sort of based on this old idea that everybody's normal, sort of, and they're all responsible for their actions. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. But I really appreciate your work, and I'm looking forward to reading your stuff. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. You know, you're bringing up, this is really a very interesting issue, the law. And part of what, you know, is being debated out there are these very issues about how do you incorporate new findings in neurobiology and how the brain works and how human behavior works into our current set of expectations about comporting yourself in public. And we've already, as I mentioned earlier, there have already been a couple little places where we've taken into consideration some mental or neuropsychiatric condition. And I do think that this is going to be a huge area of debate in our culture over the next 15 or 20 years, in particular with the rise of methodologies to actually visualize in the brain systems and or areas that we know are responsible for certain capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's already happened. It's already that people have taken brain scans into criminal court and said that this person did the crime, but because of this abnormality in the part of the brain that's involved in empathy, the crime and the sentence should be less than if that part of the brain was normal. So it's, you know, and I think that, you know, the jury, as they say, is out on all of this. But there's going to be a lot of debate about it, and there will be lots of attempts by attorneys to introduce it as an exculpating factor in a crime and as an attenuating factor in sentencing.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, it's you.
Hi. Hi, Bruce. My name is Wendy Heller. We actually overlapped at the University
of... Hello, Wendy. Hi, Wendy.
It was so nice to hear your voice on the radio.
Awesome.
I was driving back from giving a talk on a similar topic or a sort of related topic. My research is focused on anxiety and depression, and I haven't been working as much with kids except in a clinical capacity. And so it was really fun to hear somehow the way that you talk, just I can tell that we were trained by some of the same people.
That's right.
But
that's
I right. Do,
when,
yeah?
For the listeners, Wendy Heller is one of the world's most famous sort of neuropsychologists who's done all kinds of wonderful work on laterality of the brain and how the brain processes information and has incorporated that into all kinds of great clinical and research work. With.
Well, thank you very much
and
for
adults.
Saying that. Well, I guess I do have a question for you. When I tuned in, you were talking with a caller about Asperger's.
Yes.
And it raised an interest for me. We have been seeing more kids with what I would consider attachment disorders.
Right.
And you were talking about the orphanages and the impact of maternal deprivation on the development of the brain and the manifestation of autism and Asperger's. And I had heard another program on WILL a while ago having to do with a treatment for attachment disorders where I can't remember all the details, but the mom literally was touching the child for something like 3 months. Yeah, and this was a teenager, so this was not a trivial thing, but...
Right.
It seems
this
that,
is a, there's a group in North Texas that's been doing this.
All right. Well, I'm just really interested in hearing what you might have to say about treatment for attachment disorders in general, and if you think they actually can be treated, and if so,
right.
when, and so on. And again, it's really nice to hear you, and thanks, Celeste, for getting
sure.
him on.
It's good to talk with
I'll
you again, Wendy.
I'll listen.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's great to hear Wendy, too.
Yeah. She's been a guest here on the program, by the way.
It's awesome. Yeah. She does great work.
Yeah.
Well, just a couple of comments on this is that we, as I think a lot of other clinical groups that work with this population and researchers who are looking at this more systematically, have all been seeing more children that have symptoms that are relating to this sort of capacity to form normal relationships. More autism, more autistic spectrum, more PDD, more Asperger's, more attachment disorder children. And I think in part, I know that there are other elements to this story, but I know for sure one part of this story, one part of the reason is that there is an increasing number of single, overwhelmed, immature caregivers who are responsible for multiple children. So, for example, I think the number of single caregivers in the U.S. is now that have multiple children in a household is over one-third. And we see when we look in the systems that work with these children with sort of highest-risk children, the child protective system, special education, that the number of extremely overwhelmed and overtly neglectful parents is increasing. So I think that there's definitely something about a relational poverty that's going on with many of our children, or particularly when they're young, that is playing a role in the abnormal organization and development of systems that are involved in forming relationships and social communication. Now, with that said, one of the things that we've been seeing, particularly in children who have experience-related underdevelopment or abnormal organization of those parts of the brain, attachment problems, is that if these children are given opportunities for patterned, repetitive, relational, and somatosensory interactions that are in context of a safe, predictable, reliable relationship, they improve. They get better. They don't get perfect, but their relational skills improve.
Mm. Yeah.
And one of the challenges to our culture right now is that the regular medical model and the regular medical reimbursement model, the medical economic model, does not allow most communities to afford the frequency and the intensity and the nature of therapeutic interactions required to really heal these attachment disorder kids. So they end up going from, you know, 20 sessions with this person, then they get sent to a different foster home, and then they go 15 sessions with this kind of person, and this relational impermanence just exacerbates the problems they have with attachment. And sometimes we actually replicate the relational fragmentation that caused the problem in the first part.
Yeah. Really very interesting. We have to stop, unfortunately. And I want to say to Wendy, thanks for the call. And also, I think Wendy might be thinking of Portia Iverson. She has a son with autism, and she's written a book called Strange Son, and she was a guest some time back. And by the way, tomorrow we'll talk about autism again. Our guest is going to be an anthropologist, Roy Richard Grinker, who is the author of Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism. So that should be interesting tomorrow here on the Afternoon Magazine as well. Dr. Bruce Perry, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, spending the time with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bruce Perry is the author of The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist's Notebook, What Traumatized Children Can Teach Us About Lost Love and Healing. The book is published by Basic Books.